The Wind Through the Keyhole. Once upon a by, long before your grandfather's grandfather was born, on the edge of an unexplored wilderness called the Endless Forest, there lived a boy named Tim with his mother Nell and his father, Big Ross. For a time, the three of them lived happily enough, although they owned little. "I have only four things to pass on to you," Big Ross told his son, "but four's enough. Can you say them to me, young boy?" Tim had said them to him many and many a, but never tired of it. "Thy axe, thy lucky coin, thy plot, and thy place, which is as good as the place of any king or gunslinger in Midworld." He would then pause and add, "My mama, too. That makes five." Big Ross would laugh and kiss the boy's brow as he lay in his bed, for this catechism usually came at the end of the day. Behind them, in the doorway, Nell waited to put her kiss on top of her husband's. "Aye," Big Ross would say, "we must never forget Mama, for without her, all's for naught." So Tim would go off to sleep, knowing he was loved, and knowing he had a place in the world, and listening to the night wind slip its strange breath over the cottage, sweet with the scent of blossy wood at the edge of the endless forest, and faintly sour, but still pleasant, with the smell of the ironwood trees deeper in, where only brave men dared go. Those were good years, but as we know, from stories and from life, the good years never last long. One day, when Tim was 11, Big Ross and his partner, Big Kells, drove their wagons down Main Road to where the Ironwood Trail entered the forest, as they did every morning save the 7th, when all in the village of Tree rested. On this day, however, only Big Kells came back. His skin was sooty and his jerkin charred. There was a hole in the left leg of his homespun pants. Red and blistered flesh peeped through it. He slumped on the seat of his wagon, as if too weary to sit up straight. Nell Ross came to the door of her house and cried, "Where is Big Ross? Where is my husband?" Big Kells shook his head slowly from side to side. Ash sifted out of his hair and onto his shoulders. He spoke only a single word, but one was enough to turn Tim's knees to water. His mother began to shriek. The word was dragon. No one living today has ever seen the like of the endless forest, for the world has moved on. It was dark and full of dangers. The woodsmen of Tree Village knew it better than anyone in Midworld, and even they knew nothing of what might live or grow 10 wheels beyond the place where the blossy groves ended and the ironwood trees, those tall, brooding sentinels, began. The great depths were a mystery filled with strange plants, stranger animals, stinking weird marshes, and, so 'twas said, leavings of the old people that were often deadly. The folken of Tree feared the endless forest, and rightly so. Big Ross wasn't the first woodsman who went down the Ironwood Trail and did not come back. Yet they loved it, too, for 'twas ironwood fed and clothed their families. They understood, though none would have said so aloud, that the forest was alive. And, like all living things, it needed to eat. Imagine that you were a bird flying above that great tract of wildland. From up there, it might look like a giant dress of a green so dark it was almost black. Along the bottom of the dress was a hem of lighter green. These were the blossywood groves. Just below the Blossies, at the farthest edge of Northard Barony, was the village of Tree. It was the last town in what was then a civilized country. Once Tim asked his father what civilized meant. "Taxes," Big Ross said, and laughed, but not in a funny way. Most of the woodsmen went no farther than the Blossy Groves. Even there, sudden dangers could arise. Snakes were the worst, but there were also poisonous rodents called wervels that were the size of dogs. Many men had been lost in the Blossies over the years, but on the whole, Blossie was worth the risk. It was a lovely, fine-grained wood, golden in color and almost light enough to float on air. It made fine lake and river craft, but was no good for sea travel. Even a moderate gale would tear apart a boat made of Blossie. For sea travel, ironwood was wanted, and ironwood brought a high price from Hodiak, the barony buyer who came twice a year to the tree sawmill. It was ironwood that gave the endless forest its green-black hue, and only the bravest woodsmen dared go after it, for there were dangers along the ironwood trail, which barely pierced the skin of the endless forest, remember, that made the snakes, wervels, and muty bees of the Blossie groves seem mild by comparison. Dragons, for instance. So it was that in his 11th year, Tim Ross lost his dough. Now there was no axe and no lucky coin hanging around Big Ross's burly neck on its fine silver chain. Soon there might be no plot in the village or place in the world either. For in those days, when the time of wide earth came around, the barony covenanter came with it. He carried a scroll of parchment paper, and the name of every family and tree was writ upon it, along with a number. That number was the amount of tax. If you could pay it, 4 or 6 or 8 silver nucks, even a gold one for the largest of the freeholds, all was well. If you couldn't, the barony took your plot, and you were turned out on the land. There was no appeal. Tim went half days to the cottage of the widow Smack, who kept school and was paid in food, usually vegetables, sometimes a bit of meat. Long ago, before the blood sores had come on her and eaten off half her face, so the children whispered, although none had actually seen it, she had been a great lady in the barony estates far away, or so the children's elders claimed, although none actually knew. Now she wore a veil and taught likely lads, even a few lassies, how to read and practice the slightly questionable art known as mathematica. She was a fearsomely smart woman who took no guff, and most days she was tireless. Her pupils usually came to love her in spite of her veil and the horrors they imagined might lie beneath it. But on occasion she would begin to tremble all over and cry that her poor head was splitting and that she must lie down. On these days she would send the children home, sometimes commanding them to tell their parents that she regretted nothing, least of all her beautiful prince. Cy Smack had one of her fugues about a month after the dragon burned Big Ross to ashes, and when Tim came back to his cottage, which was called Goodview, he looked in the kitchen window and saw his mother crying with her head on the table. He dropped the slate with his mathematica problems on it, long division, which he had feared but turned out to be only backwards multiplication, and rushed to her side. She looked up at him and tried to smile. The contrast between her upturned lips and her streaming eyes made Tim feel like crying himself. It was the look of a woman at the end of her tether. "What is it, Mama? What's wrong?" "Just thinking of your father. Sometimes I miss him so. Why are you home early?" He began to tell her, but stopped when he saw the leather purse with the drawstring top. She had put one of her arms over it, as if to hide it from him, and when she saw him looking, she swept it off the table and into her lap. Now, Tim was far from a stupid boy, so he made tea before saying anything else. When she had drunk some, with sugar, which he insisted she take, although there was little enough left in the pot, and had calmed, he asked her what else was wrong. "I don't know what you mean." "Why were you counting our money?" "What little there is to count," said she. "Covenant man will be here once reaptide's gone. Aye, while the embers of the bonfire are still hot, if I know his ways. And what then?" "He'll want 6 silver knuckles this year, perhaps as many as 8, for taxes have gone up, so they do say. Probably another of their stupid wars somewhere far from here. Soldiers with their banners flying, aye, very fine." "How much do we have?" 4, and a scrap of a fifth. We have no livestock to sell, nor a single round of ironwood since your father died. What shall we do?" She began to cry again. "What shall we do?" Tim was as frightened as she was, but since there was no man to comfort her, he held his own tears back and put his arms around her and soothed her as best he could. "If we had his axe and his coin, I'd sell them to Destry," she said at last. Tim was horrified, even though the axe and lucky coin were gone, burned in the same fiery blast that had taken their cheerful, good-hearted owner. "You never would." "Aye, to keep his plot in his place, I would. Those were the things he truly cared about, and thee and me. Could he speak, he'd say, 'Do it, Nell, and welcome, for Destry has hard coin.'" She sighed. "But then would come old Barony Covenant Man next year, and the year after that?" She put her hands over her face. "Oh, Tim, we shall be turned out on the land, and there's not one thing I can think to change it. Can you?" Tim would have given everything he owned, which was very little, to be able to give her an answer, but he could not. He could only ask how long it would be before the Covenant Man would appear in Tree on his tall black horse, sitting astride a saddle worth more than Big Ross had made in 25 years of risking his life on that narrow track known as the Ironwood Trail. She held up 4 fingers. "This many weeks, if the weather is fair." She held up 4 more. "This many, if it's foul, and he's held up in the farming villages of the Middles. 8 is the most we can hope for, I think. And then..." "Something will happen before he comes," Tim said. "Da always said that the forest gives to them that love it." "All I've ever seen it do is take," said Nell, and covered her face again. When he tried to put an arm around her, she shook her head. Tim trudged out to get his slate. He had never felt so sad and frightened. "Something will happen to change it," he thought. "Please let something happen to change it. The worst thing about wishes is that sometimes they come true."